I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, Father James Martin, is one of the country's most popular and most well-known Jesuit priests. He grew up outside of Philadelphia in a family of what he called lukewarm Catholics. They observe religious rituals and traditions without much thought. Martin has described his relationship with God at that time as a transactional one. After studying business at the University of Pennsylvania, he headed to New York City for a job in the corporate world, but after a few years, he realized he hated his life. James Martin has written a memoir about the various summer jobs he had as a kid and how they prepared him for the priesthood. It is titled, and it's a long one, Work in Progress, Confessions of a Busboy, Dishwasher, Caddy, Usher, Factory Worker, Bank Teller, Corporate Tool, and Priest. Father James Martin joins us on The Connection today to share some of the lessons he learned when he was young, how he found his calling with the Jesuits, and his thoughts on today's many moral and political conflicts and crises. He's editor-at-large at America Magazine. He hosts the podcast The Spiritual Life. He's a consultant to the Vatican's Dicastery for Communication, and he's written many, many books. And James Martin, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you. Nice to be with you and nice to be back in Philly.
Indeed. You're almost hometown here. We can't go through all the jobs that you had as a young person growing up, but how did being a busboy dishwasher, how did that help you as a priest?
Well, I was 15 years old, 1976, in Plymouth Meeting, and I had very little power, and I was not always treated well by the patrons, shall we say. So it gave me a sense of what not to do, right? How not to treat people, particularly in service industries, particularly people who have less power than you do. And it also, because I had a very nice manager, taught me how to treat people well. It also taught me simple things like how to work hard, show up on time, right? Ask questions when you don't know how to do something, when you don't know how to mop something.
Right.
And, you know, not to be afraid to apologize when you do things wrong, which I did several things wrong as a busboy. So, yeah, it taught me a lot.
I worked in the restaurant business as well as a waitress, and I also washed dishes. And I've often felt that everyone should work in a restaurant if you want to know how to treat people and how to deal with multiple things and crazy crises in the kitchen.
Yeah, I think that's right. It teaches you some humility, but it also, again, teaches you how not to treat people. Also, funny enough, I was a dishwasher as well as a busboy, and when I went to the novitiate, the first couple of years of Jesuit training, you know, we're called to wash dishes a lot. And this one of the Jesuit novices actually said to me, you're a very good dishwasher. And
you're
really
good at this.
I'm a professional. You know, I was paid for it.
You write, as a kid, one of my chief concerns was getting people to like me. First of all, how did you do that? And why was that so important?
I don't know if that's common for all teenagers, but it was for me. I wanted people to think I was cool and had a lot of friends and whatnot. And that's kind of an overriding theme in the book, as well as, you know, trying to let go of that, you know, towards the end. How did I do that? How did I try to get people
ingratiate
to like
yourself, ingratiate yourself, right?
I think by sort of going along with the flow, right, and not, you know, upsetting the apple cart too much. Also, I tell the story about how people I knew as a teenager who were kind to people sort of on the margins and who were not popular really impressed me. And I thought that's something that I'd like to do, and I hope I do now, but I wasn't able to do when I was a teenager.
Are you a less nice person now that you don't necessarily want people to always like you all the time?
Oh, I hope I'm a nicer person. I think the key would be, for example, there was a guy that I knew who was very kind. I talk about it in the book to a guy who worked with us at the movie theater in Plymouth Meeting, and it was a developmentally disabled guy. And my friend was really nice to him, but I couldn't do that because I thought, oh, people are going to see me being nice to this guy who's uncool. So now I realize, you know, it's better to be kind, and, you know, you can sort of treat people even on the margins, you know, with dignity and, mm-hmm. and kindness. So I hope I'm kinder.
This is sort of related to what we're talking about. You also write, I'm amazed by how uninterested I was in other people's lives back then, largely focused on myself. I mean, I don't think that's unusual, especially for a young person or even a teenager, or maybe especially a teenager, to be so self-conscious and to just mostly be focused on oneself.
I guess so. What surprised me was I ended up interviewing friends for this book to make sure my memories were correct. And one of the people in the book is a woman named Chris, and we drove together every day to a factory. And I only reconnected with her recently. And I said, you know, tell me about your family. Her family were immigrants from Lithuania and had this fascinating background. And I thought, you know, we drove together in the car every day. And I didn't ask her about this. Again, you know, I'm a teenager, but still, one of the lessons of the book is, you know, take an interest in people around you and listen.
Your parents spoke Sicilian at home. Does that mean they were immigrants to the U.S.?
My mother's parents both came from Sicily, so she spoke a little Sicilian. My dad was Irish. His joke was he spoke Italian out of self-defense. That was his joke. But they would use, as I say in the book, Sicilian language for words that were sort of uncouth, right? Yeah. So you can fill in the blanks. And for times when they didn't want my sister and I to understand what they were saying. Until I took Spanish and French, and one day I translated what they said. And I'll never forget this. We were in the kitchen, and my dad said to my mom, I guess we have to learn a new language now.
That's great. I know for a lot of Jewish families, speaking Yiddish. Mm-hmm. So the kinder didn't hear either the gossip or all the, you know, swear words or whatever that the adults were saying to each other.
Yeah, one of my parents' favorite comments in Sicilian dialect was Nidji Nanta, which means don't say anything, basically in front of the kids. Right.
You have a wonderful description, and I'm a bit older than you, but I certainly remember what it was like to be a kid in the 60s and 70s, and you list some of the things that you either didn't do or did do. Not wearing a bike helmet, speaking of cars, never using a seatbelt, shooting BB guns and rifles at birds and cats and other critters, going to the highway overpass to drop dirt bombs, snowballs, rocks, and other water balloons on passing cars, perhaps most notable of all, walking to kindergarten at the age of 4. I mean, children had such a different life, I think, back then.
Yeah, and funny enough, I asked my mom, I said, is it true that I walked to kindergarten at age 4? And she said, sure. She said, I took you the first couple times, and then I figured you knew the way. And I remember walking through the neighborhood with all the other 4-year-old kids. I asked my sister, Carolyn, who has kids of her own. I said, what would happen if a mother set her 4-year-old child out to walk to school? She said she'd probably be arrested for child endangerment. So yeah, but things were different back then. And also we knew that there would be probably someone at home. If you got into trouble, you can knock on the door and, you know, ask for help. But yeah, 4 years old walking to school.
Yeah. But did you enjoy those kind of freedoms?
I did. I found, you know, sort of reviewing my life and writing this book, I grew up in not a perfect time, of course, but pretty idyllic, walking to school and feeling safe, you know. There was never a question of, you know, were you safe? You would just be outside and relax and play. And, yeah, looking back on it, it feels like a bit of a vanished time.
Yeah. You went to Wharton at Penn, undergraduate Wharton at Penn. And you write that you were basically interested in making money and having fun.
Yes, those were the two things. Those are the two goals I had at Penn.
And thinking a business degree would give me the money. And you also write a lot about smoking pot and drinking a lot. I mean, that should not be unusual to anyone listening to our conversation, but that was the fun part.
Yeah, I was very happy to get accepted at Penn at the Wharton School, which they told us was the best undergraduate business school in the world. And I got a great education, worked very hard at Wharton. The goal was to get a good job and make a lot of money. And, you know, I came from a middle class background. And so that was important to get a good job and pay off your college debts and whatnot.
Sure.
At the same time, I had a lot of fun drinking, smoking pot. I don't ignore that in the book. And if I did, my friends would, you know, remind me.
Right.
And so I had a great time at Penn. I think one of the themes of the book, though, is, you know, was I really sort of aiming at the right thing in terms of going into business. And that's where things change for me a little later in the book.
But do you, in a sense, forgive yourself for maybe some of these youthful transgressions, if I can put it that way?
Oh, sure. I say in the book that, you know, I look at myself the way that I hope anybody would look at a 17-year-old kid, right, who, you know, drinks and gets high and does some crazy things that I talk about in the book. You know, God is merciful, right? And we believe in forgiveness. And funny enough, a couple years ago, I wrote a memoir about entering the Jesuits, and I talked about getting high and getting drunk and whatnot. And they use it in a lot of Catholic schools. It was more overtly religious. And a principal wrote and said, can you write a letter disavowing some of these things, right, for parents? And it turned out he said he never had to use the letter because all the parents had had the same sort of upbringing that I did. So, yeah, I forgive myself. And I would forgive any 17-year-old kid for something like that.
Well, you headed to New York City to work for GE, General Electric, in the PR department. Is it, that's kind of where you ended up?
I was in finance and accounting first because I got my degree in finance. And then I ended up in HR in GE Capital in Stamford, Connecticut.
And you learned to hate it. Or hate your life. You said, I hated my life.
I did at the time. You know, business is a real vocation for a lot of people, right? I want to make that clear. And I have friends who spent their whole lives in GE and were very happy and, you know, led fulfilling lives and contributed to the common good. It just wasn't for me. And it took a while for me to figure that out. I stepped onto a kind of a conveyor belt at Wharton that sort of delivered you into these high-paying jobs, right? Which was fun. And I had great time in the 80s in New York. But eventually I just thought, this is not for me. And I really started to hate it. But I just couldn't find a way out.
Were you depressed?
Oh, sure. Depressed and had migraines and stomach problems and ended up seeing a psychologist. And so the problem was I had sort of aimed at this for my whole life, right? You get, you know, I worked hard at Wharton and got a good education. And now I'm in business, you know, something that I thought was going to bring me happiness, and I was pretty unhappy. So the question was, you know, where do I go and what do I do?
In fact, this psychologist asked you a very simple question, but one that opened up parts of the world to you. What did they say?
Yeah, he did. I had seen a documentary about Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, and that got me thinking about entering the Jesuits. I made some sort of, you know, overtures to them. And then really sat on it for a couple of years and thought about it and did a lot of reading. At the same time, I was going to see this therapist, as you say. And he said, well, why are you at GE if you don't like it? And I said, well, what else would I do? I remember sitting in his office and he said, well, you could do all sorts of things. And I said, well, I wouldn't know what I would want to do. And he said, well, this is the question I think every young person should be asked. What would you do if you could do anything you wanted to do? You know, to really kind of dream. And I said, well, that's easy. I joined the Jesuits. And he said, well, why don't you? And I thought to myself, yeah, why don't I? And I went back and I called them and, you know, then started that process. So that question really changed my life.
And it was a question that had never crossed your mind?
I think not in that way. I mean, my parents were wonderful people, right? And they really supported me and my sister in terms of education and, you know, really said you can do what you want. But my dad was a businessman. And I didn't know too many people who were, I don't know, teachers or artists or anything. We grew up in a street where everybody went to, all the dads went to work. I got a great education at Penn, and it just never crossed my mind. No, there weren't people to say, why don't you dream big, right? And what else would you like to do? And they certainly didn't do that at Wharton. You know, that wasn't their job. So it wasn't until, you know, age 27 when this therapist asked me that it kind of unlocked everything for me.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Father James Martin. He's written a new book, probably his 20th, that's what he thinks, or in that ballpark, and it's titled Work in Progress, Confessions of a Busboy, Dishwasher, Caddy, Usher, Factory Worker, Bank Teller, Corporate Tool, and Priest. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. I'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Jesuit priest James Martin. And again, he's got a new book, a memoir titled Work in Progress. I would love to have you read a section from the book, really, which speaks to what you said right before the break, but just to hear it in your own words.
Sure. So here's the quote from the book. I might edit one little sentence out.
Sure.
Let me put this into context. I'm a 25-year-old corporate tool who has worked hard in a succession of summer jobs, studied hard in high school and college, and now has what he was aiming for all along, a promising financial career. My childhood dreams of being comfortably wealthy seemed within reach. I had plenty of wonderful friends, too. But the focus of my life was work. And now, work, around which my college education and the rest of life revolved, seemed to have failed me. Wharton set me on a conveyor belt that led to a high-paying job, but that job didn't seem to be what I wanted. One night, while reading No Man is an Island by Thomas Merton, I came upon this passage. Why do we have to spend our lives striving to be something that we would never want to be if we only knew what we wanted? Why do we waste our time doing things which, if we only stop to think about them, are just the opposite of what we were made for? Yes, I thought as I sat in bed, that's me. But what was I made for? By now, I knew that the answer was not working at GE. Maybe, I thought, without knowing much about it, but based solely on Thomas Merton's life, I could become a priest.
And again, James Martin reading from his new book, his memoir, Work in Progress. You saw this documentary about this Trappist monk, Thomas Merton, and it seems that it totally changed your, turned your life upside down.
It did. I always say my life was changed by PBS, right? I saw it on Channel 13. Yes, exactly. I had come back from a miserable day at work. I plopped myself down in front of the TV. It was like probably 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. And on screen came this documentary. You can still find it online, called Merton, a Film Biography by Paul Wilkes. And I just was captivated. There's this guy, Thomas Merton, who left everything behind. He joins the Trappist monastery in the 1940s, and I just thought, this is so beautiful. It just seems so romantic, you know? And I, it was sufficiently interesting that it prompted me to go out and buy his autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain, and I just was captivated by it. It just seemed like such a better way of living one's life than what I was doing at the time.
I mean, did you feel like you were sort of ripe for something so different and so spiritual versus money-oriented?
Yeah, I think what happens is, the way I look at it is that God is always trying to break into our lives, but when we are vulnerable and sort of broken, God is more able to break in. That doesn't mean that, you know, God's kind of hitting us over the head, you know, with a hammer to like make us more vulnerable, but we're just more open. And I think I was so miserable and so ready for a change that that documentary just was able to break in. And that really, I can say that documentary changed my life.
You described early on as a young man growing up that you had a transactional relationship with God, which I'm assuming is, well, if I'm good, then I'll get an A on my test or something along those lines, that it's about negotiating back and forth, yes?
Exactly. Yeah, if I do this, God will do that, right? If I'm a good boy, God will reward me in some way. You know, like it's like a gumball machine. You put a penny in, right, and then it comes out. That removes, you know, like any and all freedom of God's working. Right. And I think a lot of people deep down still have that idea. If I'm a good person, I will get rewarded in this life. You know, I'm going to get good things. But also, sometimes the flip side is something bad has happened to me, and therefore I must have done something bad to deserve it. So there's a dark side of that transactional way of looking at God. I had to move beyond that.
That reminds me, and every now and then I'll hear this or I see it on television where something terrible happens. But there's a child, let's say, that's a survivor, and the parent, you know, obviously they're very grateful, but they say, you know, God looked out for my child when all these, let's say a school shooting, I mean, the horror of that. The message being that God didn't look out for the rest of the children.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to talk about because you do want to know, and I believe that God is looking out for all of us, but that is the question. What does that mean about God's relationship and care for the other people who were not so lucky? So again, we have to move away from this idea of sort of a quid pro quo.
Writing in your book, you say the notion that God would, through experiences in prayer and daily life, want to communicate with me was absolutely life-changing. It was as if someone had turned the radio to a station I hadn't known existed before. What are you talking about here? What did that mean?
Yeah, I believed in God, right? I mean, I believe God existed. There's a short part in the book where I sort of move away from that. But the idea that God would take an interest in me, that God would want me to sort of listen to God's voice, the idea that God would communicate with me seemed kind of both arrogant, right? Like, who am I? And a little delusional. But once I accepted the invitation to believe that God is communicating with us in all sorts of different ways, in prayer, but in relationships and nature and work and all that, it was pretty transformative, because then you start looking around and trying to notice, right, where God is. So that was a big change in my life. I went from, basically believing in God to believing in a God that was a more personal God.
Hmm. And how do you communicate with God? What is that relationship about now?
Well, I think in my own life, it's about prayer, first of all, right? It's about the one-on-one time with God, which is really important. But it's also about noticing where God is communicating with me through my life, right? Through my friends and my work and whatnot. And then trying to communicate with God back by, you know, fulfilling my vocation and trying to be a good Jesuit priest. So it's really about, you know, Jesuit spirituality and more broadly Christian spirituality. It's a lot about noticing, being aware, paying attention, right? Because a lot of times we just sort of, you know, we kind of move on and we don't take the time to reflect and to say, where has God been in my life and where has God been in my day? Right. I mean, I always say there's a Jesuit prayer called the examination of conscience, where you review the day and you look back and say, where has God been? And I always think it's easier to see where God was than it is to see where God is and where God will be. So that kind of gives you strength to look in the present and look in the future.
Well, maybe an unfair question is for you, is God with us in the studio?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, just in terms of our conversation, but also to be frank, the opportunity to talk about God to lots and lots of people in the Philadelphia area, that's a wonderful opportunity for me and for me to talk about my relationship with God. So definitely.
Mm-hmm. And prayer, I mean, for you, prayer is do you live in prayer? And I'm
that's okay.
I'm asking this as if I know nothing about anything. But what does prayer mean to you?
Yeah, so prayer is that one-on-one time with God. So, you know, some people say that everything is prayer, which you could say that. You live in a prayerful way or, as we Jesuits say, a contemplative in action. But when I talk about prayer, I'm talking about, you know, really closing my eyes, imagining myself in a scripture scene, speaking to God, trying to listen for God's voice. And I don't mean literally hearing voices, but, you know, insights, emotions, memories, desires, all those kinds of things that come up. You know, I pray every day for an hour in that way, that contemplative way. I also do an 8-day retreat. We Jesuits do an 8-day silent retreat where you're, you know, just doing that for the whole day. For me, it's one-on-one time with God. That's how I understand prayer.
And how did being a Jesuit, I mean, you could have been a different kind of Catholic priest, but why the Jesuits?
Yeah, great question. I would say, of course, Providence. But what happened was I was working for GE in Stamford, Connecticut. And I saw this documentary, as you were saying, and I went to my parish priest, kind of all full of myself, and I said, I think I'd like to be a priest, you know, despite knowing nothing about it.
Right.
And he said, well, you should talk to your local archdiocese in Philadelphia. You should talk to the Diocese of Bridgeport. And he said, as an aside, you might as well talk to the Jesuits up at Fairfield University. And I went to see them, and that just kind of clicked. They just sort of felt more like home, you know, than the other options. And I started to apply, and I was in a couple of months. And I was embarrassed, as I say in the book, because there were guys who had, like, you know, investigated the Benedictines and the Trappists, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I think I spent more time picking out a car. But it worked.
And did your family understand it? Did your parents understand why you went from GE to the priesthood?
No.
No?
No.
Were they opposed, actively opposed?
They were upset. My mom, God bless her, who's a lovely person, never lets me forget that I told her on Mother's Day.
Oh, dear.
I told her in front of my sister. They both cried. I mean, because they thought, you know, I had really not shared any of this with anybody because I wasn't, you know, in a very religious family. I didn't share with many of my friends. They were horrified. They thought I was joining a cult. Wow. My mom thought that she'd never see me again, right? You know, I'd be sent to some, you know, missionary country. Funny story, my friend Chris at GE said, you know, I had to tell all my GE friends that I was quitting. He said, you should see a psychologist. And I said, I am seeing a psychologist. And he said, he paused and he said, maybe you should see another psychologist. No, my friends thought I was kind of nuts. My pen friends, as I say in the book, took bets on how long I was going to stay in the Jesuits. The outside bet, the longest was 6 months.
Wow.
So
that's
40 years.
You showed them, right?
That's right. I should have taken the bet.
So what has kept you there as a Jesuit?
I love the life. That's the first thing. I feel it's right for me. It's my vocation. And also, you know, I made vows. I took vows after 2 years as a novice. I made promises as a priest. I made final vows as a Jesuit. But it really, it's the life. I think I entered the Society of Jesus for what they did, right? You know, they can teach and they can run parishes and they can, you know, work in refugee camps. But I stayed for who they are. The spirituality of finding God in all things. But it's my vocation. Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Father James Martin, and he has written a number of books. He's got a brand new one, and it's a memoir titled Work in Progress. And I'll just do the subtitle again. I got to do that, right? Confessions of a Busboy, Dishwasher, Caddy, Usher, Factory Worker, Bank Teller, Corporate Tool, and Priest. And it's about the many jobs he had as a young boy growing up outside of Philadelphia and how he ended up as a Jesuit priest. I do want to take advantage of the fact that you are a Jesuit priest and living in America, as we all are, and your thoughts, your feelings, your reactions when we observe what is being done in the name of our government. And I'm talking specifically about the use of ICE and these agents who are dragging people out of cars. They shot Renee Good. They shot Alex Preddy. We are seeing children being taken from their families. I mean, it's just a horror. And the cruelty is just so palpable. And as a priest, maybe, and as a human being, what do you see there?
I like the way you frame that. As a priest and as a human being, I'm horrified. It's disgusting. And, you know, I often think, let's assume that some of these people are actually breaking the law. And we know, and I'm sure you know, that most of the migrants are here illegally, right, and are trying to go through the legal system, right? Let's assume that some of these people have broken some law. No one deserves to be treated like that. I mean, even if you are. Look, I have one of my closest friends is George Williams. He's the Catholic chaplain at San Quentin. He deals with mass murderers, right? He treats them with dignity, right? They have the sacraments. They go to mass. No, it's appalling. And I don't know how people can sleep at night, frankly. So I think it's a real sort of affront to human dignity, right? These are people who are being abused, and it's hard for me to find the words. It's the way that people are being treated is an evil. I mean, we really need to say that. It's an evil.
You wrote about Renee Good and Alex Preddy. They are children of God. I mean, is that what you were saying, which is that they deserve dignity, love, respect, care?
Sure. And even if you're not religious, right, and you don't want to speak in those terms, these are human beings who have innate dignity, right? And no one deserves to be treated like that. And so I'm sort of speechless sometimes at how sad it makes me and how appalled it makes me and how horrified I am by seeing this happening in the name of, you know, my government too.
Right.
So it's an evil, really. The treatment, the abuse and the violence is really evil.
I do want to play a clip of House Speaker Mike Johnson, but just something quickly that you wrote, and this was in America. This is the Jesuit Review. This was January 12, 2018, so the very beginning of the first Trump administration. And the first thing you said was, Jesus himself came from a S-hole place. Obviously pushing back on what then-President Trump had said about people coming from these countries he didn't like around the world. But I thought that was strong on your part.
Well, and Jesus comes from a poor, or at least not a wealthy, family. He is in a marginalized village. His family, for a while, are refugees or at least internally displaced people in the flight into Egypt, right? They have to flee King Herod. Interestingly, they fit perfectly the textbook definition of a refugee, which is someone who's fleeing out of a well-founded fear of persecution, right? Jesus constantly talks about welcoming the stranger. The story of the Good Samaritan is about welcoming a stranger. I mean, I don't know how you can read the Gospels and not understand how we're supposed to treat migrants and refugees. It could not be clearer. You do not need to have a PhD in New Testament studies to understand this stuff.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is a slightly edited clip, and this is Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, and he was asked earlier this week about Pope Leo's criticism of Trump's harsh and quoting Pope Leo here, extremely disrespectful mass deportation efforts. Let's give it a quick listen.
Immigration is not something that's frowned upon in Scripture. In fact, it's welcome. We're going to welcome the sojourner and love our neighbor as ourselves. But what's also important in the Bible is that assimilation is expected and anticipated and proper. When someone comes into your country, comes into your nation, they do not have the right to change its laws or to change its society. They're expected to assimilate. Romans 13 says that the civil authorities are God's agents of wrath to bring punishment upon the wrongdoer. And it says, if you do right, you have no fear of the civil authorities, but those civil authorities are necessary. It's a calling. It's a calling to maintain order in society, and we have not had that.
There's the Speaker of the House arguing with Pope Leo about what's written in the Bible.
Yeah, and I think that that ignores the entire thrust of the Old and the New Testaments, which is basically welcoming the stranger, right? Exodus, if you want to quote scripture, Exodus says, "You shall not oppress the resident alien, for you yourselves were aliens in the land of Egypt." You know, God's talking to the people of Israel. And, you know, let's look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritans and the Jews, for a number of reasons, were kind of at odds with one another. And a Jewish man is lying by the side of the road, and it's the Samaritan, the one from the hated group, that comes and helps him, right? Mm-hmm. So this is about neighborliness, right, and helping people who are kind of outside the sort of your community. But one of the things I like to remind people about the Good Samaritan is that the salvation of the beaten man depends upon the one whom he considers to be other, different, stranger. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, upon whom does our salvation depend, right? And I would say it's the migrants, the refugees, the strangers, the people that we consider other. So, look, I think that, that quote, you know, St. Paul is talking about observing civil rules, you know, which makes sense. And, of course, we have a right to boundaries and things like that. But, you know, you can also look at Jesus in Matthew 25, who said, "The way you treat the strangers, the way you treat me." And, by the way, these are not just kind of personal moral decisions. That section in Matthew 25 where Jesus talks about welcoming the strangers is often called the judgment of the nations, right? So these are not just sort of personal things. These are things that, you know, societies are going to be judged on. But I don't know how you can look at the scriptures in any other way than saying that we need to welcome strangers. And so I side on this one with not only Pope Leo, but Jesus.
Well, I won't argue, you know, that says a lot. Here's a headline from the National Catholic Reporter. We're almost up in a break here, but it says, "Catholics must decide if they serve Donald Trump or the gospel." Do you think it's that stark?
Yeah, I wouldn't use President Trump's name because I think that's sort of setting him up as, you know, always against the gospel. But I would say Catholics need to choose between right and wrong, between sort of charity and injustice, and cruelty and kindness. I mean, I think that's the choice here.
And we are going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Father James Martin. Again, he's got a new book. It's a memoir called Work in Progress. And he is a Jesuit priest, editor-at-large for America magazine. We've got much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Father James Martin. He is editor-at-large at America Magazine. He hosts the podcast The Spiritual Life. He's also a consultant to the Vatican's Dicastery for Communication. I had to Google Dicastery. And he's written a number of books, including a brand new one called Work in Progress. Let me ask you how you find, if maybe there, I don't know if there is a middle ground between the church and the state. I mean, we live in a country that allegedly has this separation between church and state, and we have freedom of religion and freedom from religion. Is there some comfortable place in the middle of those two where you feel you can operate?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a political scientist or a theologian, but I think you can bring the voice of faith, you know, as Pope Leo does and the U.S. bishops do, into the public square and, you know, make a real contribution. I think the key is, you know, not saying that, you know, God is only on my side, and if you disagree with me, you know, you're disagreeing with God, right? And I think that's what's used a lot these days. But, you know, there's a role for religion in the public square, and there are a lot of people in the Catholic Church who do that very well.
Such as?
I think Cardinal McElroy in Washington. He's the Archbishop of Washington. Yeah, why do I say that? He is, believe it or not, a PhD in both political science and theology.
Oh, interesting.
So he's really good at kind of articulating those kinds of things. You know, I think Archbishop Perez has done a great job. I think there are lots of—
That's here in Philly,
yeah,
right?
Here in Philly. I think there are a lot of people, but also not just speaking out, but really standing with, for example, migrants and refugees, right? I've seen lots of bishops and priests and sisters and Catholic lay leaders who have gone to detention centers and have protested. And so it's about, you know, also it's not just actions, but it's not just words, but actions, you know, the way Jesus taught, not just in words, but deeds.
Let me ask you, and I was, you know, reading your book and thinking a lot about the Catholic Church and also having this Epstein sex scandal unfolding around us. And I wonder if there aren't some parallels between the pedophile scandal of the Catholic Church, where powerful men, if I can put it that way, were abusing children. There certainly were enablers, people that looked the other way. And we're seeing something very similar with Epstein and those people that knew what was going on or had some hint that there was something really terrible happening with him and these young women or these girls. Do you see some parallels there?
That's interesting. Not until you brought it up. That's really interesting. But I do think this idea of who's believed, right? I think one of the foundational reasons for the sex abuse crisis, in addition to the sickness that is sex abuse, you know, that causes these crimes and these sins, is that people didn't believe the victims or the families. And so it's clericalism, which is what we call in the church, right? Even though, you know, mothers would come and victims would come. And I would imagine, I don't know as much about the Epstein case, yeah, that people were, you know, trying to blow the whistle and weren't listened to because they weren't as powerful, right? And just the kind of inability of people. I also think there's a kind of fundamental inability of people to imagine that happening. Right?
Literally, so like, almost like seeing it.
Well, meaning that, like, I couldn't imagine someone would do something that terrible, and that happened a lot with in the priest sex abuse crisis. Like, oh, Father so and so is so great, I couldn't imagine him doing that. So there's a bit of a sort of reluctance on, you know, people's part to kind of assume those kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, if the sex abuse crisis in the church teaches us anything, it's listen to the victims, right, yeah, and pay attention to them, right. So, yeah, so I do see those parallels now that you pointed them out.
Do you think the church has dealt effectively and correctly with the sex abuse scandal?
I think there's never enough that we could do. But I think that one of the greatest things that the church has done, it took us a long time, and this is, you know, not everywhere in the world, is that anyone who is credibly accused of abuse is immediately removed, right, you know, from ministry, which is right. Right. Now, I don't know if that's the same everywhere in the world, but we're getting there. And so there's also restitution paid to victims. Right. And there's a whole office at the U.S. Bishops Conference that just does that. And certainly in formation, you know, in training of priests, we hear about it frequently, which we should. Right. And so I think we're making great steps. The goal would be, right, and it's a long goal, the goal would be that the church would be the group that people would look to and say, this is the way to deal with it. And I hope we're moving in that direction.
I read something like only 30% of Catholics go to church regularly. Does that seem about right?
That's about right. Yeah, and I think that's not just the sex abuse crisis. It's all sorts of questions about church teaching, but it's also just growing secularization, right? People are just, you know, less religious across the board, I would say.
Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, I mean, as a Catholic, it's certainly a problem if it's only 30%. I think that people are missing out, I would say, going to Mass and availing yourself of the community. Yes, definitely a problem, especially speaking as a Jesuit priest.
Do you think people that don't believe in God, and I'm including myself in that crowd, that we're missing something really important in our lives?
I do. I don't judge them, of course, right? And I don't think you're going to hell, you know, because of that. I don't, because they're good people, right, that try to live moral lives. And I think God has mercy on people. But I do think that, you know, people who are not going to church and who aren't believing are, in fact, you know, missing out on this relationship with God. I mean, I wouldn't be in this job if I didn't think that.
You have really reached out to LGBTQ Catholics. This has been kind of a mission of yours, if I can put it that way. There's a group called Outreach, which is trying to find a place for gay Catholics in the church. Why, first of all, why that particular interest, and how is that going?
Outreach is our group. It's part of America Media, and it ministers to LGBTQ Catholics. A little plug, you can go to outreach.faith. Yeah, it was not something I planned to do. I mean, I knew LGBTQ people. I live in New York, and I minister to them. But in 2016, the Pulse nightclub massacre. The response from some of the Catholic leaders at the time I thought was really paltry, and so I did a Facebook video that said that. And I basically thought to myself, you know, what does this group need to do to get the attention of the church? Do they need to be murdered? Is that like not enough? That led to a talk, which led to a book, which led to this ministry. So I didn't plan on going into it, but that seemed to be where God's calling me. And then I ended up meeting with Pope Francis, who said, I can say now that he's dead, he said, I want you to continue this ministry in peace. And he was very supportive. And so it's sort of grown. And I think there's a real need for it as well.
In fact, Pope Francis said, "Who am I to judge?" I mean, that's the kind of famous thing he said when talking about homosexuality.
Yeah, he was asked specifically about gay priests. That was, and I think probably the five most famous words he ever said, which was such a shock. He, I think, did more for LGBTQ Catholics than all of his predecessors combined. First pope to say the word gay. You know, he knew transgender people. He worked with people who ministered LGBTQ people. There was a real opening of the door there.
How about for Pope Leo? Is it too soon to know where he stands on all this?
No, it's not too soon. I met with him in September for about a half hour, one-on-one. And the message I got from him was that he wanted to continue Pope Francis's message of welcome and inclusion. So I think he's very much in Pope Francis's way of doing things in terms of that community.
I did a little bit of research on this because I'm not so familiar with it, but I read that being homosexual is not a crime, but it is a sin. Is that a good way of seeing the yes and the no?
Yeah, it's not a sin just to be gay. That's really important to say. The church still considers same-sex activity immoral, right? But I think the problem in the Catholic Church, and I would say among a lot of Catholics, is that they focus so much just on that one community. There's lots of people whose lives are not in conformity with church teaching. I mean, you know, people who don't pay a just wage, people who, are cruel, people who don't forgive, people who don't give to the poor. But it seems to be just the LGBTQ people who are singled out for this kind of attention. So what we're trying to do in outreach is basically to make the church a more welcoming place. And that's what Pope Francis was trying to do when he said, you know, todos, 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 you know, everybody is welcome.
How do you do that? How do you make it a more welcoming place?
Great question. One would be to listen to the needs of LGBTQ people. The other would be to welcome them, you know, really sort of take steps to welcome them in parishes. And then I would say finally to advocate for them, you know, because there are plenty of things I often say that the church could do without changing any church teaching. And one of them is something that Pope Francis did, which was to support the decriminalization of homosexuality. I mean, that doesn't change any church teaching, you know, because, you know, in something like 10 countries, you can be executed for being gay, and something like 70, you can be jailed. And so, you know, in many countries, I often point this out to Catholic leaders, it's a life issue, right? It's a life issue. It's a life and death issue. So there's lots of stuff the church can do to make it more welcoming to that community.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Father James Martin. And again, he's got a new book, a memoir titled Work in Progress. Pope Leo invited a bunch of comedians to the Vatican a couple of months ago. Is there a connection between faith and humor from your perspective?
Yes, actually, it was Pope Francis. Pope Francis invited some comedians. I actually had a hand in sort of helping them. You know,
oh, you did?
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah, it was fun and funny. Lots of funny stories I could tell. He wanted to share with this group that I think is, you know, often not, you know, focused on in religious circles and say, look, it's great to make people laugh. It's great to laugh, you know, and it's great to laugh even about religion, he said. And I was there during the meeting, and there were people like Stephen Colbert and Julie Dreyfus. And let me tell you something interesting. They were all really moved by the Pope's words. I found that really interesting. I didn't know most of these people, but once they walked into the Vatican, first of all, they were a little awed, which is, you know,
it's an amazing place.
It is an amazing place. But they were really moved by what he said, because I don't think that community gets a whole lot of support from religious leaders. So it was a lot of fun and a lot of funny sort of stories, too.
Well, speaking of Stephen Colbert, he called you chaplain of the Colbert Nation. What does that mean for you?
He dubbed me that a couple of years ago, and it's meant that I go on from time to time. Yeah. I was just on a couple nights ago, which probably is my last time because the show's ending.
That's true.
So I think I was on for the first time in 2007, believe it or not. It's been a lot of fun. He's a great public representative of Catholicism.
How do you stay humble? And I asked that sort of following up on the Stephen Colbert. Not everyone gets to go on Stephen Colbert or has the kind of fame, I would say, that you have. Do you have to keep yourself in check?
Oh, no, I just look in the mirror. I mean,
really?
You know, I'm well aware of my foibles, and, you know, I live in a Jesuit community, right?
People, so they'll remind you, right?
Yes, and I mean, they don't take me too seriously, and neither do the people I work with. And I mean, you know, they respect me and everything, but, you know, I work with Jesuits who are presidents of universities and who are teachers and who are working with refugees and migrants and doing all sorts of important things, and this is just another way of being a Jesuit. No, yeah, and part of it is not taking yourself too seriously and, you know, kind of getting over yourself. But Jesuit life will do that for you. Keep you humble.
I ran across a quote from you saying that actually the Beatitudes are sort of harder to follow and keep than even the Ten Commandments. I might be overstating that a bit, but I think that's kind of the gist of what you were saying.
Yeah, I was talking about people arguing for the posting of the Ten Commandments, you know, outside of public buildings and right. in classrooms, and I suggested why not post the Beatitudes, right? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers. How about blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness? How would that look up in a public building or a classroom? So I think we tend to forget the Beatitudes. And it's funny because it's mostly Christians advocating for posting something from the Old Testament rather than the New Testament. So the Beatitudes are pretty tough. Blessed are the poor.
Blessed are the merciful.
Mm-hmm.
Blessed are the peacemakers.
Mm-hmm. So I think that would be very good to put up in front of public buildings.
You also, I found a quote that where you said, Jesus said, follow me, don't worship me.
Yeah, that's a quote from Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan. I mean, I worship Jesus, of course, but yeah. I think he points out that Jesus was asking his followers more to follow him, literally walking in his footsteps, I mean, physically, but, you know, being merciful, forgiving, right? Treating the poor with kindness and, you know, looking at the marginalized. And we tend to forget that, right? He says elsewhere, which I love, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will get into the kingdom of heaven, meaning just saying you're Christian doesn't do it. You really have to walk the walk.
What's the best part of being a Jesuit priest?
Now, I should say the spirituality,
okay.
right, which I love, or
yeah.
saying Mass, which I love. But honestly, it's my Jesuit brothers, really. That's one of the greatest benefits. I didn't think that I would have so many brothers, you know, and friends. And that to me is really one of the, as Jesus says, the hundredfold, right, that you get when you sort of leave things behind. Yeah, it's a great, it's what I was made for. And it took me a while to get there, but I'm happy I got there.
What is that relationship about? I mean, what makes it so meaningful to you?
With my Jesuit brothers?
Yes.
It's just I love them and they love me. And my joke is always, they're like brothers, you know, you love them and they drive you crazy sometimes.
really?
Yeah, well, sure. I
yeah.
mean, you know, we're
okay.
very close. And I've known some of these guys for 40 years. So it's just been a great, and to work together with them is also amazing too, right? I mean, to work in the vineyard, you know, with my brother Jesuits and working for those in the margins. And, you know, the fact that I do this LGBTQ work and my Jesuit brothers can call me and say, thanks for doing that. Or, hey, you know, I get a lot of emails like this. Hey, thanks so much, Jim, because someone in my parish, you know, told me that the outreach work is really helping them feel welcome, right? So I feel really supported by them and, you know, supported by Jesuits all over the world. So it's a great brotherhood.
How do you deal with things like death threats or people that are trashing you online, which clearly happens?
Yeah, I talk about that in the book. One of it is a freedom from the need to be loved, liked, or approved of. That's the first thing that came up on a retreat. I was praying about what's called the rejection at Nazareth, where Jesus stands up in the synagogue at Nazareth, and you know, people initially like what he says, but then they want to kill him, basically.
Right.
And I was on a retreat, and I was praying about it, and I asked Jesus in my prayer. I mean, I didn't hear this, but I imagine myself asking Jesus in prayer, you know, how were you able to do that? How were you able to stand up in front of these people who were, you know, townspeople who grew up there? And the words that came to me in prayer were, must everyone like you? And I think that was an invitation. So that's one way. And also to know that I have the support of my Jesuit brothers and my superiors. And also, finally, to know that I think I'm doing the right thing. I think making the church a more welcoming place for people is in line with what Jesus would want us to do.
Interesting, coming full circle about being, wanting to be liked as a kid, that's a theme in your life.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that until I finished the book, frankly, that, you know, I'd spent so much of my teenage years, you know, sort of like angling to be liked, and now I have to be comfortable with people not liking me. But I think if you just do things for people to like you, you become paralyzed. And I always say to people, you know, Jesus would have never left Nazareth. He would have been, you know, still sawing wood in Nazareth if he waited for everybody to like him. So thank God he didn't.
So you're proud of people not liking you? It feels good to be not liked?
I don't know about that. I think I'm still a human being, but it doesn't bother me quite as much.
Well, on that note, Father James Martin, thank you for joining us today on The Connection.
My pleasure.
And again, he's got a new book. It's titled Work in Progress, Confessions of a Busboy, Dishwasher, Caddy, Usher, Factory Worker, Bank Teller, Corporate Tool, and Priest. And those were the summer jobs that he had as a teenager growing up here in the Philadelphia area. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Builder. Al Banks is our engineer. Thank you so much for joining us.